begin opening the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve a common problem and help each other to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I have this super badass guy, Jerry, here tell us his story for about 10 minutes.
Hey, everybody. My name is Jerry, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hey, Jerry.
When I first came into the room and I heard somebody said that they were grateful, I really didn't understand that. I didn't get it. I thought they were insane. I get it now. There was a time where I didn't feel grateful at all for what I had or for what anything was in my life, and I have a lot of gratitude and a level of gratitude that I wasn't able to experience before. My sobriety date is June 29th, 2007. And I grew up in the Bay Area, and I'm going to throw in here, I know I have like a strict 10-minute timeline, so I'm going to make this quick. I grew up in the Bay Area. I took dance class when I was 6, and little did I know that dance class would turn into a career until I was 31. So I was able to work professionally for 12 years. And also, my name is Jerry, but my birth given name is Leslie. So, being 6 years old, taking dance class, being a Mexican who doesn't speak Spanish, and being called Leslie, I felt like I was trying to live like 8 different lives when I was 10. It's pretty amazing that I was able to get through that because I felt like I wasn't bullied, but I knew I always had that inner thing of feeling of things wanting to be just a little bit different than they were. When I first came into this room, I heard that you just don't have to pick up today. If you would have told me I couldn't drink the rest of my life, I probably wouldn't have stayed. That was a little bit too much for me to grasp. Just don't drink tonight, and then try it again tomorrow. And you really don't have to think after that. So that made it really easy for me to understand and comprehend, because I couldn't even figure out a few hours. There would be a point in my drinking where I knew I wasn't going to stop. I had a few, and I was like, I probably should stop, but I know I'm not going to. That's not going to happen right now. And that's what it was like for me. Now, what was most important to me when I was drinking was the next drink. If you can imagine, now God forbid we were all drinking tonight, but can you imagine if we were drunk right now? Like, there would be some people fighting over here, probably some people kissing and making out over here. I would be that guy on the floor, or maybe on the table dancing with my shirt off. There would be people trying to kill themselves. I might be in the back, in the dark, drinking by myself too, because that was the kind of drinker I was too. We would all be doing something just a little bit different, but probably most of us would be thinking about that next drink. And that's what it was like for me. I was a little bit messy. I was the guy who before ATM cards on airplanes, but I would take the cup I had for my drink and I would walk down the aisle and shake it because I ran out of money. That was me. If I saw your drink and it was red and I was at a club, I probably would take my cranberry juice and switch it and drink it. It wasn't fun. I couldn't imagine sustaining that kind of life for a while. Even when I was young and I knew that there wasn't a solution, and I knew I didn't want to drink like this, but I knew that I wasn't happy, but it's not what I wanted. It was pretty miserable. There was a time, too, like when I worked on cruise ships as a dancer, we sailed out of Barcelona, and we were in the Mediterranean for 4 months, and we had overnights in Italy. It wasn't that common that we had overnights, and there was one overnight where I was drunk the whole day. and all night, and I don't remember any of it. And it's a shame that I was over there working in something I was very passionate in. I was very passionate in dance. Lucky enough to be able to work as a dancer. I didn't know how lucky that was. I thought everybody just grew up in dance class, and then when they wanted to keep going, they just worked. Right? I thought it was that simple. That's what it was like. And I had a glimpse of what a solution might look like. I just knew it wasn't what I was doing. There was two, I think, main feelings that I had during that time. It was, I really want to drink, or I'm never going to do this again. I remember friends sometimes when I was working either in Vegas or ships or wherever I was saying, "Oh my God, you were so funny last night." And I had no idea what they were talking about. Did I try to kiss you? Did I try to hit you? Like, I didn't know what happened. Like, I was like, yeah, cool. And I knew I wasn't a bad person. And I felt like I was. And I think down the line, I realized that I wasn't a bad person trying to become good. I was a sick person trying to become well. And that's what, at the time, I thought AA might be the solution. I didn't know what this was when I got here. I thought it was like, you're going to help me quit drinking a little bit less and I can go out more and not be such a crazy animal. And when I heard that you had to not do anything, I think that was about the time I was 27. I went to one meeting and I left and came back when I was 33. I thought it was like a church. I thought there was, because I didn't have a really strong religious background. How am I on time? Okay. My sister died before I was born. She was six. And my mom was Catholic, and she didn't have a really strong faith in the Catholic religion. So it wasn't an influence on me either way. And when I came here, I thought there was one set of rules that we live by and one set of rules that you don't. And I realized that's not the case. We just don't hurt each other, and we're good to ourselves. And everything else is up to the individual. If you're new, just come back. It's that simple. I can't save anything. I can't think of anything profound that I did or anything outstanding outside of the program that I did. I just came back. I got a sponsor. I've created my own higher power, which is completely different than what it was in 2007. And I have, honestly, a life beyond my wildest dreams that I ever thought I could have. This journey has been great. I have friends. I have people that I can count on. I have better relationships with people. My family, that drives me nuts, I have a relationship with them. I was able to get through a breakup, losing my dad, losing my cat of 20 years. All those things were just things that happened. And I was able to use tools from this to get through what it's like. So I'm going to end with that. When I came here, I didn't know how to have fun. I thought sobriety was the end of the road. When I thought, okay, I'm grateful to be here, and I heard people say that, I was like, but this is AA. This is like the end of the road. Like, why would you be grateful? It's not. It was just the beginning for me. So welcome if you're new. Keep coming back, and thank you.
Now we're going to have the main.
No. This is for the Boskin as well. My name is Rosalind. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Thank you, David, for asking me to share this evening. I haven't done this in quite a long time. Many, many years ago, I used to speak all over the country, and I started to think I was a president of AA. And that's when I knew I was in trouble. Actually, you were in trouble. And I had to stop doing it because I lacked humility. And that was when I thought I knew everything. It was about 20, 25 years ago. And now I know I don't know anything. And I don't speak very often. But I always say yes to when I'm asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I also want to welcome anybody here that's new, because when I was new, my sponsor made me come to these meetings where there were just speakers, and she told me that was how I would learn to listen, and she said there was always a happy ending. And that's what my sponsor is like to this day. She's very into, you know, it's not in the big book, okay? But her thing was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and every day I had to say what dwarf I was. my sobriety date is December 24th, 1975, and don't tell me how many of you were not born at that time. I'm not interested. that was my last drink, my last drunk, my last drug. For me, sobriety, and this is, let me say that when I share what my experience, strength, and hope is. And that's all I have, is my own story. And so I got sober in New York. I do not have an accent. And in New York, sobriety was, you know, drugs. They used to say, if you put it down your throat, stick it up your ass, shoot it in your arm, it's the same old stuff. And that also meant no cough medicine. My sponsor said no rum raisin ice cream. And so that I have been clean and sober since that time. I went to Whole Food the other day because I was sick, and they have this thing called kombucha, and I guess it's a healthy thing. And guess what? It's got alcohol in it. And that's a no-no for me. Light beer, no-no. And that has been that's my story, you know, just my story. I can't tell anybody else what to do unless you're someone I'm sponsoring. I'm not going to talk about my brother. He can tell his own story. I come from a home where there's no alcoholism. And when I first come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to sit in the room and I used to think about why I wasn't an alcoholic. You know, that person would talk and I'd say, I never did that. I couldn't be an alcoholic. In New York, at that time, at the Mustard Seed, which is where I got sober, everybody seemed to be an Irish Catholic. I, therefore, was not an alcoholic. I couldn't be an alcoholic because I had never lost my a husband or a wife. I'd never been married. That was irrelevant. I had never lost my license. I'd never had a car accident. I'd never lost a car. I had never learned how to drive. Irrelevant. I had never lost my family. My children never had them. Irrelevant. And so I compared myself to everybody. And that's our choice on any given day. We can compare, we can look at our differences, or we can look at our similarities. And for me, the similarities have usually been the feelings. And there isn't one person here that I could not identify with. And so, if you're new, please try to identify with the feelings, because our facts may be quite different. The fact is that I'm a drunk, and I love to drink. And I came from a home where there was no alcohol, no drugs, no food addicts, no gambling, and here I am. So, you know, who cares? For me, analysis is paralysis. So I don't analyze. I just keep coming to meetings one day at a time. I started... understanding that what happened for me is that my dad died when I was 5 and a half. He got sick when I was 3 and a half. He had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And my my aunt, who loved me, died right immediately thereafter. And I think what happened to me is I detached. And I have what we now sophisticatingly call attachment disorder. But I just detached from the world and disconnected from the world. And my mother's solution at that time was no money. We were very poor. She was from England, and we moved back to England and lived with my grandparents. And then when the going got rough there, we moved back to America. When the going got rough here, we moved back to England. And blah, 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 blah. And so I knew that my life was unmanageable for a long time before I picked up a drink. I felt like, well, actually, they used to say, Roz is so good, you don't even know she's there. And that was my story. I was nothing. I was invisible. If I was in the room, there was nobody there. My mother had a huge personality, and my brother has a big personality. And there was only room. There was not room for me. And so when I picked up, actually, I started taking diet pills when I was 12. Now we call them amphetamines. And I wasn't fat, but I went, anyway, I went and I got them. And for some reason, I had this theory in my head. I don't know where it came from. If one is good, 12 is better. That's my theory. And by the way, I can apply that to Alcoholics Anonymous, in case you're interested. And so, if one meeting is good, 12 is better. So I started right from the get-go. And boy, it was great. I had the cleanest room. You know, and I know now that I had, now I've been told I have ADD or whatever the hell it's called, but, you know, there's a lot of letters. But, you know, it was the only time I was ever able to be focused. But also, it took me away. And, of course, I started smoking. And shortly thereafter, I was working in the Catskill Mountains. And I was very young, chronologically, but very, very old head. And people used to say, Roz, you know, why are you so serious? You're so serious. And I felt, goddamn right, I'm serious. You know, I have the weight of the world on my... You know, I always felt like I had to take care of my... I was my mom's mom. And so we were in a room, the staff, we were in this room. I'll never forget it. Never forget it. And how many years ago was that, 100? And, you know, we're sitting on two couches and on the floor, and they pass around a bottle of rye. And someone said, oh, yeah, let's see what happens if Roz takes a drink. And the, I always thought the joke was on them, because once I got that bottle, I did not pass it on. And guess what happened that night? My life became manageable. I had the solution. There was one little problem. I had a blackout. I passed out. I threw up. That was a problem. But I knew that I had a great time somewhere in there. And I also knew that I had become blonde. I had become blue-eyed, and I had become very tall. So I found the solution. And from that moment, I think I was 15, to the moment I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for what I hope was the last time, when I was 29 is when I got sober. I started coming way before then. On a daily basis, that was my solution. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, and that power was alcohol. I knew it was a power greater than myself, and I made a decision, whether it was conscious or not, and I turned my will, my life, my money, my teeth, my education, my body over to the care of alcohol, and it didn't take that much very good care of me. And I changed my name. I didn't. My story is really about not wanting to be me. So I changed my name. I wanted to be Italian. I was called Tony. I wanted to be Irish. I learned the Irish jig. I only drank in Irish bars. I didn't want to be white, so I told everybody I was African American. I would, for 1 year, I wouldn't talk to white people. Men. Then I thought my problem was women. And ultimately, I thought my problem was the United States. You know, it was getting bigger and bigger. And what happened in those years is I was a blackout drinker right from the get-go. And so, and I was a bar drinker. And I would end up anywhere with anything at any time, anyhow. I was willing. I worked all the slogans of this program. First things first. It was very clear to me what was first. I can't say I worked easy does it, but I didn't do think. I did drink. I was willing to go to any lengths for a drink. I always worked. I always was a hustler. I always had a job. Switched a lot of my drinks. I drank Dirty Mothers, you know, scotch with milk to line my stomach. bottles of olive oil to line my stomach because I didn't want to get thrown out of the bar so soon. You know, my bottom was very gradual. I just kept getting thrown out of the bar earlier and earlier, and that was the problem. So what happened for me is that I think for me, I just didn't want to be who I was. I just didn't want to be who I was. And so on Christmas Eve, 1968, I think I was 22, I went to Midnight Mass. Because I was Jewish, so I always would go to Midnight Mass before Christmas. And I wanted to be, you know, Christian, Catholic, whatever. And so I waited for Midnight Mass, and everybody was very friendly. And by the way, I was living in Brooklyn Heights at this time. And people were talking, and there was this big, big bowl of punch. And I thought, oh, this is fantastic. And all of a sudden, at some point, everybody moved from one room to this room. And they sat like you are. And this woman had the audacity to get up here and say, my name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. And it was an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I just couldn't believe how unfortunate these people were. And I told them. And I was carrying on. I was drunk. And I told them that they were sad, that I felt sorry for them, that their life had ended this way. And I was, you know, I wish them well. And I went to the bar and I said, you're never going to believe what happened. And we all had a drink. And so I remember that. I of course, didn't belong there. It was just an accident. You know, I was going to sing with the choir, even though I couldn't sing. It was irrelevant. I have a lot of irrelevance in my story. When I was 25... this is an important thing for me. For these, I had a period of 4 or 5 years where that story, when we read for more about alcoholism in the book, that was my entire story. Because it wasn't that I wanted to control my drinking, I wanted to control those blackouts. Because I was waking up in different states. The place that I worked in a law firm. And they used to, when I call in the morning, everybody would get on the phone and they'd say, what state is she in? What state is she in? And I would say, Ohio. And then somebody would say, I won. And they would place bets. And I would come in. And the reason they never let me go is I was great. But I just had I came in 12, 1, 2 o'clock. Didn't drink in the morning. I just drank when I woke up. And I just didn't wake up in the morning. So therefore, I was not a morning drinker. And I decided the problem was the United States. I went to my bar that night, and I said, guess what, everybody? I'm going to stop drinking. I'm moving to Italy. And much to my chagrin, the whole bar cheered, because I was not an ice drunk, by the way. When I didn't drink, I was almost phobic about being modest. I was polite. I was very polite. I had learned my P's and Q's as a child. Very courteous, kind of quiet. Talk about Dr. Jekyll and Ms. Hyde. I had an immediate personality change. So I would come into the bar and they'd say, oh, you were amazing last night. Do you know what you did? And I would not know. And they'd say, well, you came up from the bathroom. You were stark naked and you were singing cabaret. I would never give me a drink, because I didn't want to know that I did. And so that night in the bar, when I said I was going to stop drinking, I ordered a beer, because I thought beer was not alcohol. Because it went down easy. It was not booze. And I had about 18 beers. And with every one of them, we all cheered. Here's to Roz not drinking and moving to Italy. Everybody got into it. And I went back to my apartment. This is one of the rare times I was not in a blackout, because I thought I hadn't been drinking, really. And the next thing I know, I were flames, ceiling to floor, and I was in a brownstone with like 26-foot ceilings. And my apartment was on fire. And so was, anyway, I thought that I was killing people in the building. And anyway, the next thing I remember is back in my bar, and somebody's holding my face like this, and somebody's pouring gin down my throat. And I remember saying, this is clear as day, this is what happens when you stop drinking. And nobody said, but Raja had 18 beers. And I really felt like that's what happened because I stopped drinking that night. And they say, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. I don't know if I was smoking in bed. That's what they say. I don't know. But I had nothing for anybody to go after. And I lost every single thing except my life, which, by the way, at that point meant nothing to me. And I needed that. I mean, I'm embarrassed to tell you that I was one of those people that just needed to lose everything. Because if I had one thing left, I don't think I would have made it in here. And so for the next 4 years, I just moved to, you know, rooms and hotels. And the last apartment was, I was walking on the street, 30th Street, between Park and Lex, hooker hangout. I had done that too, but I wasn't good at it because I always was looking for a meaningful relationship and they just wanted a trip. Another story. So, I remember just really meeting this man. And this man said, you know, hi. And I said, hi. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm looking for a place to live. And he said, I own this building. There's one person who lives here, but she's looking for a roommate. She's not there now. And I said, okay, I'll move in. I never met her. And went back to my apartment. I couldn't pack. I'm incapable of packing. Called a mover, and they just brought barrels and threw whatever shit I accumulated, which wasn't much, because from the fire, I didn't have much. I had what people gave me. And I was supposed to meet the mover on 30th and Lex in front of the building. And I went upstairs to say goodbye to the neighbor, who I had never met before. But I wanted to say goodbye. And he asked me if I wanted a glass of wine. Of course I did. So I got to the apartment 2 days later and was angry that my stuff wasn't there. And the woman turned out to be a junkie. And ultimately, from the two of us, and that's when I started trying to... I was in a tiny room. I had a small room. And I would lock the door of the room and put the dresser against the door so I couldn't get out to drink. I would put the bedroom furniture against the door. I didn't want to get out to drink. And then within a short time, now I had to pull all the furniture away so I could get out of the room to go to the bar. And the bars got sleazier. And anyway, you know, sometime in 1974, I ended up on the street. And from that time, summer of 74, till shortly before my last drunk, I was homeless. And this is how I just would knock on doors between 23rd Street and 34th Street, 14th Street and 34th Street, between 1st Avenue and 3rd Avenue. If a man answered, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, I would ask him if he had a bed, because I always felt like I could pay my way. So my bottom was not sexy. It was because I could no longer pay my way, because I started passing out. I couldn't perform. And I started coming to meetings in August of 1975. I had been in an outpatient program. I had been having seizures, so what? You know, having been in the hospital lots of times, so what? No big thing. That was my nickname, no big thing. And no big thing, give me a drink. I started coming to meetings. I didn't feel the love in the room. And to tell you the truth, I would go from the meeting to the bar, pass out the literature at the bar. Who knows? We'd all laugh. Sometimes if a guy wanted to, you know, do something with me, I'd say, okay, but let's make a stop first. I'd take him to a meeting. I have no idea if he stayed or whatever. I had my last blackout at the midnight meeting. And so I just kept coming. And that's my story. My story are these three words. Keep coming back. Keep coming back. today I think it should just be stay, stay, stay. And I just kept coming back. And for me, there is a power greater than myself. There's a group of drunks doing something together that I could not possibly do on myself. I couldn't. I tried everything. And they started coming, and there was this stupid woman at the mustard seed. She used to sit in the first row. And she was, I couldn't stand her. And she'd say, "My name is Sue, I'm a happy, grateful alcoholic." God, this is what we've come to. And by the way, the mustard seed was great. It wasn't in the church. And also, you could go in the door, and I just, I was always afraid they would lock me in. So I would go in the door, and I'd go out the door. I'd go in the door and out the door, just to make sure they weren't going to lock me in. And Sue's husband was Eddie. And Eddie was also sober and had become a unity minister in sobriety. He was a very good friend of Bill W. They both were. And somebody gave me a dime. That's how much calls were in those days. No comments. And said, you know, use it. And I started calling Eddie. I got one room. I got a room across the street from the mustard seed. Had a card table, four chairs, and a mattress on the floor. First time I ever spoke in a meeting, I said, "My name is Rosalyn. I'm an alcoholic. I have, I think, 110 plants, and I think they're coming to get me." And everybody said, "Keep coming back." And Sue became my sponsor. Not because I wanted what she had. I did not. But we were in this beginner's meeting, and what happened is it was this newcomer who came in the same time as me, and I thought she was going to get Sue first. And I have done a lot of good things for the wrong reasons. And my reasoning was wrong, because I wanted to get her first. And so I got her. And actually, we both did. And she became my sponsor. If you are new, get a sponsor. It is so hard. It's hard. It's hard to do. It's never easy to ask somebody for help. My sponsor changed my life. Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, changed my life. My sponsor, Sue Myler, was the first person in my life who loved me. And loved me absolutely, unconditionally. Now, she did have some conditions. I wasn't allowed to have the rum raisin ice cream and the cough medicine and all that. And I wasn't supposed to get involved the first year. She brought me a t-shirt. It said, "My sponsor says no, I'm supposed to wear it." She did things like the Seven Dwarfs. She adopted me. She and Eddie adopted me. I learned how to play pinochle. It's not on page 35 in the big book. But she adopted me. They took me into their family, and she loved me. And in New York, I couldn't read. I was really a mess. The most difficult decision I had to make in my first year, and I just had not much time left, so I want to be cognizant. I remember I was sober about 6 months. And by the way, I went to 30 meetings a week for the first 6 years, because that's all I did. And I remember going to the 5 and 10, Woolworths. Most of you don't know what that is. And I had to get a dish drain, just a plastic dish drain. In those days, you could get white, brown, avocado green, or mustard yellow. I spent hours going back and forth. I asked everybody, "What do you think?" And they'd say, "What color is your kitchen?" I'd say, I don't know. I had a kitchen. I had a tiny thing. It was the most difficult decision for me. I couldn't make a decision. And so I didn't get anything. And I'm just sharing that's what it was like for me. Because I had been, you know, when I got here, I felt like, I used to say, "My name is Roz and I'm a minus 10. I just felt like a nothing. Like just one big pile of nothing. I can't tell you a whole lot about feelings because I tried not to have them. And I actually thought that Alcoholics Anonymous would do for me what booze did for me. So if I went to enough meetings, that maybe I wouldn't have to feel anything. And so when I would hear people cry at a meeting, I would think they weren't working the program. I'd say,
where's your gratitude list?
And if you went to a movie, if I heard that you went to a movie, I knew you weren't working the program because you were supposed to be at a meeting. And I had all these rules. They were not in the book, but they were my rules. I feel so bad for the people I sponsored. I was so self-righteous. Oh my God, I can't stand who I was, but I was that person. And I've met many of me in the rooms now, by the way. They say things that aren't in the book, and they say them like they're rules. But the big book is very clear, and it's very simple. And I don't like the way it's written necessarily, but the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, to me, are perfect. They are perfect. And we're just human beings. And so Sue became my sponsor, and I would have a little time. She'd physically take me. By the way, I was half my size. It's another story. She would take me and physically throw me into your lap and say, talk to them, she's new. And she got me involved in service immediately. And service saved my ass. And when I was, I don't know how many months sober, I became a sponsor of a 16-year-old. I was actually 28 or 29. And we started going to young people's meetings. And that's where my life began again. And I got very active in young people's and went all over the country with young people's AA conventions and conferences and service and eventually chairing the international conference in New York in 1980, I think, or 81, learning about principles before personalities. I also want to say that I guess the most important part for me of my recovery is I don't believe necessarily in the word recovery because it feels like I'm recovering something that I once was. And I wasn't anything. So for me, the 12 steps have been about discovery. And that's what I feel goes on for me in these rooms. That I begin to discover who I am and who I'm not. And so when I see the 12 steps, you know, I tell people the story, and many of us have heard it, where they said to Michelangelo, how did you create the Statue of David? And he said he took a piece of marble and a chisel. And he chiseled away at everything that was not David. And that's a visual for me that I can really see. And that's what the 12 steps do for me. They chisel away at everything that I'm not. And so I'm constantly, excuse the expression, coming out. And by the way, that's something else that happened in sobriety. when I was 6 years sober, I was told to stop volunteering for everything. I sponsored a lot of women. I co-chaired a prison meeting. I secretary of the Bill Wilson dinner, blah, 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 blah. You know, I had just used, and Ethelyn DeGroot told me I had to stop raising my hand to volunteer. And that was a very difficult year for me. And at the end of that year, I had been secretary in the meeting, and I said, cheerio, thank you for the privilege of allowing me to secretary this meeting. And I took a cab down to the lesbian meeting. And I hadn't slept with a woman sober. I did. I came out in blackouts, but I don't know what happened. And they used to say, don't ask. And I thought, okay, good. And so I went to the lesbian meeting. And I said, here I am. And I began to know a new freedom and a new happiness. OMG. And again, for me, I'm constantly coming out. I'm constantly coming out. The Roz who was in there is constantly emerging. It's very important for me to share that at 29 years or 20-something years of sobriety, I moved to Denver, Colorado with my then partner. and they didn't recognize me. They didn't realize who they had at their meetings. And nobody, like, you know, dropped to the floor and said, "Oh my God, she's here." And I was very offended. And I did not want what they had, and I told them. And I felt like I was in Christians Anonymous, you know, and New York is much more inclusive. And this was very homogeneous. And I had a problem, and I did share. And, of course, I didn't make a lot of friends. And I stopped going to meetings. It was gradual. And to make a long story short, after a number of years, luckily I had my contacts from New York, and I had a lot of literature. I've always been a literature person. I've always been a grapevine person. But I got involved after my partner and I were together 20 years. We separated, and I met somebody and who was an active alcoholic, cocaine addict, and got involved and started buying her the most expensive bottles of scotch and, you know, and came. My pinky nail is a little long right now. It needs to go to have a manicure. But it came that close to my next drink. That close. And I got in my car, and I did a geographic, and I don't give a shit. And I took a leave of absence from work, and I drove around the country and went to meetings and came out here and said, "That's it." And I moved out here. And that was 10 years ago. And got right back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very, very, very lucky and very grateful that I did not pick up a drink or a drug, but I was insane. And for any of you, I think maybe we all go through that at times. My prayer for myself is that I don't go through that again. I go to meetings regularly. I have a home group. I have a sponsor. My first sponsor is not, I still call him my sponsor, but she's 83. She's in Jersey. I spoke to her today. I love her. I love her, and I love her. She has me sing this ditty every single day that I've been singing for 39 fucking years. Every single day, I'm alert, alive, awake, enthusiastic. I'm awake, alert, alive, enthusiastic. I'm alert, alive, awake. Awake, alert, alive. Alert, alive, awake, enthusiastic. And the reason... me do that is because of the power of the word that so often will say, "How are you?" And I say, "Oh, you know, I'm miserable." And my sponsor had me do this thing where she would say, "I can have my feelings, but I had to choose a good, I had to choose a positive word." And so she'd say, "How are you?" And I'd say, "Oh, I'm fucking wonderful." And or I would call her. I'd work in the Empire State Building, and I'd call her, and I'd say, "I'm going to commit suicide." And she'd say, "Okay, it's okay. Just call this phone number first, and then call me back." And I'd call the number, and it would be, "Dial a joke." And I was so angry that I became homicidal as opposed to suicidal. And so what did he teach me? He taught me I do not take myself seriously. Let me tell you how I am today. I am so unbelievably happy. I don't have money in the bank. I'm driving a 20-year-old. I can tell you about all the externals. It's irrelevant. Some of it you can see. But let me tell you about the internals. The internals are... I'm happy. I'm just happy. I'm so grateful to be alive. I had a stroke 6 years ago. And I'm so grateful to be alive. Every day is this gift that we get. And when things happen and life happens, I lost my mom. That was devastating. I didn't think I was going to live through that one. But when life happens, it happens. But this is the deal. It doesn't have to consume me. So right now, I have a rotator cuff injury, and I'm in a lot of pain. And yes, I have a rotator cuff injury, and I'm in a lot of pain. I am not my pain. That is what I'm feeling. But what I separate my feelings from my facts. That's from my sponsor. Everything I have is from my sponsor. So the facts are that I am alive, I am sober today, I am grateful. I have a power greater than myself. Thank goodness that I am not God. And in New York we say you don't have to believe in God, but you have to know that you're not. And I know that I am not. And it's a gift to have a power greater than myself in my life. I have the 12 steps. The only way I know how to change, the only way, is through these 12 steps. And I'm a 6 and 7 kind of girl. I have a good life. This is the silliest thing. I'm a pet sitter. I did this thing for 100 years. I'm a pet sitter. This was not what I planned. I'm happy. I don't know what to say. I just am so lucky. I feel so lucky to have Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel so fortunate that you were here. Some of you were here before me. And to me, the greatest service we can do for the newcomer is to be here, is to come to meetings so when new people come in, we're here. That, to me, is the greatest service. And anyway, thank you all for my recovery.